هي يمه ودعيني قبل ما امشي، ما تدري بعثراتي وانا امشي.
I'm someone that loves the moon a lot. Like, I'm someone that talks a lot to the moon. When we call someone my dearest, we call them my moon. Like, Kamari, which is like, you know, the Kamar is the moon, as like my sweetheart. So the moon become like the beauty. So like, it relates to love. We say to someone, you are like moon, beautiful. You know, like, مثل القمر, we call it. So like, it relates us culturally to beauty. Culturally to the kind of pureness of things, because it's white and it's kind of bringing that kind of pure space to people. No matter how dark these nights, the moon will come and light them up. And same for our history of 70 or 100 years of colonization, we know that the moon always comes up, no matter what. And even when the clouds are covering it so much, in between the clouds you can always see that moon. And that's more of a symbolic that, you know, that the victory will come and liberation will happen, even the darkest times, even the hardest places.
Hey, yumma, wadda'ini qabil ma mshay. ما تدري بعثراتي وانا مشي، يا قايد المراكب يا قايد المراكب يا قايد المراكب قيد وامشي، عسى الله نلحق وضع الاحباب.
I'm a Palestinian woman, born and raised in Jerusalem, the oldest of five children that lived and was born in the Intifada. It's a weird way to think about introducing myself, especially now, because I feel like I'm a lot of things and sometimes lost in a no way and nowhere. I'm a passionate person about my people and our cause. And I think everything I could describe myself will just be part of who I am as that. As an artist, as an advocate, as, you know, a mom or a daughter or a sister or a grandchild of women and amazing fighters for freedom, even silent fighters that by their existence they're fighting, you know, occupation and oppression. Dad's parents had a strawberry field and my mom's parents had a grape field with lots of figs. That's where I love figs from. And I know that, you know, I smell my grandmother. She doesn't sweat, she land in a way. It's like you smell her, the smell of the land on her body. You know, you just run into her chest because like the way she smells the land. So in between that, that's really loving the land and breathing it is what we were raised to do. I learned from them love, because basically when you go to my grandmother's house, you, by the time you finish saying hello and hugging everybody, it's time to go home. And that's really generosity and love, but love as deep as it can go. Like the hugs that you get there, like just like heal you. And I learned generosity because I never saw neither my grandparents or my parents' house or any house closed. So we say that by the time we finish breakfast, it's lunch, and by the time we finish lunch, it's dinner. And by the time dinner is over, it's time for tea. And people don't go home until khalas, like we are all dead, basically. But it's generosity. And even when I genuinely think that my mom had nothing in the fridge and there's a guest knocking the door, suddenly there's a feast. And I'm like, where did all that come from? That's what they teach. And they don't, you know, tell you that's how you should do it. They just teach it by doing it. But when I came here, I felt like that's how having a house means I need to have it open. And having it open means I need to feed. And just like the smell of my grandmother, you smell it in and you breathe it into your veins until land is in you. These things that people teach you, it just makes you who you are. It's like in your blood, in your skin, in the way you look, in every small detail. As children, we didn't really like hear like stories or specific, you know, things about the moon. More than it relates us with the new beginnings. And it relates me to the time my grandmother, before I even started fasting, the full 3 days of moon is like when there's delicious dishes, because that's the 3 days my grandmother used to fast, like al-ayyam al-bid, the white days of the full moon. Regardless to all the, you know, holy kind of space and spirits, but it's kind of really the time when we all gather together and we all cook and eat. And that's kind of when I felt related to my kind of community within that 3 days first.
Ya qaid al-marakib, ya qaid al-marakib, ya qaid al-marakib, qid wimshay, asa Allah nilhaqo da'in l-ahbab.
Living in Jerusalem, it's the most beautiful city, but the most complex feelings to walk in those streets. Like enjoying everything from the calls of the aunties, like calling for like selling nana and parsley and sage and like the fresh of vine leaves, but also watching the soldiers, like, you know, surrounding them. It's walking in the streets and seeing how old and deep and ancient and strong these walls have been over years and years of colonizers and people that just invaded that place. And watching kind of like this army surrounding it, walking to pray and knowing that you find this silent and, you know, release in that prayer, but knowing that the way to that space and the way out of it is full of danger. You don't know if you will make it, you don't know if you will get out, but you're still willing to get put yourself into that danger just because of the sake of this holy, important piece of land, you know? It's delicious being in Jerusalem. It's better being in Jerusalem. It's so mourning. And it's so beautiful. It's my, you know, when I was born and opened my eyes and crawled in the streets. And yet every time I go with my mom, even if I in my 30s, she holds my hand so tight, thinking that, you know, she never knows who is going to grab me or take me or arrest me. Because even my eyes have resistance. And that was so scary for people to look at. This city is the same one that teaches to resist. So how can you just be a quiet person enjoying your dual citizenship of a country that shouldn't ever existed? I think lots of children also relate to the three stars close to the moon that I always look, where are they? And, you know, when there's a hard night, you feel like this is the three stars that really carry all your secrets that you can tell them to. After we left Jerusalem to go where my parents were born, we lived in the fourth floor. And from it, this is kind of where I always could see the moon. It doesn't matter where the moon is, you can always find with that small room. And as a child, as like leaving Jerusalem where I was born and not finding many, like many friends in the new place, the kind of things that you can talk to without judgment become your closest friends, even if they cannot talk to you back. And as a child, you would imagine like all these kind of laid back conversations that you imagine that the moon could say to you. When you tell them about how mean people were, or like how you bullied as a new child in the street or whatever, suddenly that becomes your safe space. Whenever we lose hope of where we are going and how we are dealing with things and so on, suddenly the moon becomes that hope in the dark.
Hey, Yuma, ودعيني قبل ما روح. Hey, Yuma, ودعيني قبل ما روح.
So when I first came here, I went to WA, to Perth. Much as I love this place now, mostly because I can be me and I can fight for a home, regardless of this racism happening, and how, as someone that is coming with so much generosity and having lots of closed doors that I'm not used to, had to, with no language, with no home, with no warmth, deal with such a cold individual country. That was like just starting a new life in Mars, like, you know, just knowing nothing and no one, and being bold and frank and an activist didn't really work. Like, it was two ways, like to give up my identity and blend, or be me regardless to what people think and say. And I think you know who I chose. But the first weeks of first coming here and then realizing the history of this place, which I knew nothing about, were like a shock and a slap on my face of like, hell, this place is so much like home. I felt uprooted. I felt that I just didn't want to be here. I felt like, why would I be what I hated that people were for my people? Why would I be part of what is happening for this land? I cannot be here. Like, I cannot do what people did to me. Until I was really welcomed by the amazing First Nation community there and then here. And just realizing the common stories and histories in between us. No matter how white this place is, they just never gave up. And their history go way before ours, yet they teach us a lot of resistance. I see it in their, you know, the way they step on the land, the way their dance is. Like, I see the dabke in the First Nation dance. I see the songs, the Palestinian songs, in the way they sing, the way they, like, call, the way they hold and they hug. I'm personally feeling so grateful having these women around me, and I really couldn't survive without having them around, teaching me what culture is and what land is and what resistance means and how long it could take and that what price we could pay, yet never stopping doing it, you know.
ما تدري بعثراتي وانا روح ما صبر صبري ما صبر صبري ما صبر صبري لا يونس ولا نوح ولا أيوب لمن ابتلى.
One of the first experiences in Australia was when I was in WA, in Bunbury, volunteering in a multicultural centre, like a migrant centre. And I didn't really speak English properly. I didn't know anyone. And I felt really a stranger because not many of the people there wear hijab. Even if they were Muslims, they were not really feeling comfortable wearing the hijab. So they will go to the mosque with the hijab and they're taking off after. And I was making art with like a 4-year-old, and she kept looking at me like with an open mouth and really a curious eyes. And I was like, are you okay? And she's like, do you have hair? And that's like as simple as any child will see me wearing a hijab have. Like, and I have no question why would she ask that? Because fair enough, like, why do I cover my head? And I asked her, do you want to see? And of course, she was so excited, nodding like a million times. And I took her to the end of the corridor where the toilets are. And before I just could even like, just like, you know, like have my hair down, she was running to her mom. Mom, she has hair. And that was like, these kids are so passionate. They are so curious. They are so fresh and pure. And I took heaps of my hijabs and my under hijabs, and I just like went to schools and just explained it to the little ones of like, that's how it looks, and to the older ones, that's when we have to wear it, and like talking about timing and when and why. And then suddenly those who were pointing at me being stranger started waving as like, I know you. And that's kind of the change that starts sometimes in literally one piece of fabric that people are not really willing to see, and ignoring the facts of like the change that can be made, you know, with it. So here, when I create artworks with children, I talk about the lullabies that children need to learn in their mother tongues, and encourage mums to share their own mother tongue lullabies. There's a million other lullabies that people can, you know, hear in different languages. And what about the First Nation language and lullabies, like the people of this land that we are privileged to be welcomed to be at? Why don't you start with those first words so that your child knows that this is the land I am at, and that's the first language I need to know about, and about the history behind it, and about what my ancestors did to damage it. When I first came here and I was a part of a program at Footscray Art, they asked me to create something, and all I could think about is really trying to analyze deeply, because living in Palestine all your time, you don't think about who you really are, because you know. But coming outside of that, you start adding lots of levels and layers of your identity that you didn't really think about when you were on that ground. Bukje is the sack of belonging, is that sack that any traveler, or mostly person that is forced to leave at very zero chance circumstances, cannot even think about the suitcase and where did they hide it. They just grab, you know, a piece of fabric and wrap it and put everything. And the first bukjes in our country were made to last for 2 days, because they said, just gather where you can, we will be back in a few days. And here we are, like more than 76 years, just going through the same thing, and way more. And I'm sure there were way more bukjes before even 1948 that were made for those freedom fighters that, you know, were trying to even fight colonization before Israel was even started or happening. And I asked people, like, if they, you have to leave home, what would you take? Everybody has a bukje of emotions, of complexities, of identities, those that they know and those that they haven't discovered just yet. And having all of these complexities and calling it bukje is actually what ended up happening. Just telling stories of home and having to leave it, telling the stories of those who have been displaced and those who were forced to, between climate, fire, war, and just the choice of being heard and being seen as full identity people carry. They're all forced in a way or another to kind of leave their homes. And that's where their sack of emotions sometimes, delicious smells or stories really that they have hidden for sometimes lifetime. And I speak to people in their 90s and they have never shared these stories, come together and come out and being listened to and shared in sometimes a meal or like a whole 1,000 people space to be heard. People relate bukje to really bringing those people home, like in language, in culture, in the small touches that bring the community together through their own languages. to be able to kind of honor and respect their own languages the way they are, even if no one else around them in the street speak it. Every single nation that ended up in Australia had a different one that is really worth knowing about and hearing about. And how many don't even know where their parents were born, what languages speak, what kind of dishes they make, because they just blended, sadly, within a community that doesn't really respect their roots. And how sometimes traumatizing at a later age to kind of find your identity that you didn't really get. So children age is kind of the most beautiful time to start any art project, any passion, any kind of seeds to plant, because they are the ones that have the most moist and supportive, you know, soil to kind of grow these seeds and to make it big and be the ones advocate later on, you know, for their cultures and their, you know, their identities too. مع السلام وين رايح مع السلام يا مسك فايح مع السلام وين بدك لك عود على دربك وردك I love anything that the land gives. I forgot when I really last cooked. So my brain is, you know, this war has just made everything just tasteless and having no meaning or taste really. But every time I really want to feel home, I have one spoon of za'atar and olive oil. And sometimes with no olive oil, just like that whole spoon full of za'atar, as dry as it is, in my mouth. And that's what home, taking me home, means. My mom gave me some olives and I have been eating it for the last 2 years, because like every time I really want to go home, I just have one and like literally go home with it. I have za'atar that I slowly kind of just like inhale in a way, to feel that I'm still alive and I'm still at home, even if I'm really far from it. I really make the dishes that we ate as a group. It has to be everybody that I love in the room, because you don't make a feast for one people or two. People might think it's poetic, but it's like, it literally takes you home. Like with the sounds, with the people, with the cheering, you hear your mom and the spoons and the fight over the, you know, the whatever left in the pot. Don't take all the eggplant. Like all of these things really come to your head. You hear these voices. You're feeling like you are like imagining or hallucinating, but it's really so real that you cannot ignore it. And you become really suddenly somewhere else every time you flip that dish. So I started cooking to really feel like I'm still back in Palestine, because that's how we love, you know. Liberation is the dream of everybody I ever met in my life. And every time you speak to them, no matter how old they are, it's just they talk about liberation and they talk about the return. So to live for 37 years, promised that something will happen, and to live the disappointment of every new year coming with it not happening is like kind of a continuous trauma, and like sing for it but never seen it. But also never losing the hope. That's what liberation means to me. I live it every day, even if I feel it's dead sometimes. I look at it and I shake it. And it's like a ghost you live with that you don't know if they are real or not, if they will come back or not. if they're going to happen again or not. It's hard, you know? It's such a inspiring, you know, word to hear all the time, because, you know, the amount of, you know, love that people have for it to happen and the passion for it to happen. Like, it's kind of the dream and the thing that we lived all our life waiting for. And I just don't know how long it lasts, but I'm certain that it will come. And I'm certain with the God promise that it will happen. And if anything, that brings me even closer personally as a religious person, is knowing that my only hope in having it, you know, happening is God. That's one of the hardest things that I say to people when I came to Australia. Don't you ever tell a Palestinian that God doesn't exist. Don't you dare to do that, because you are really killing our only hope in us being free. Liberation would not come only from us. It will have, like, it needs a different power that we don't have, you know? We just need to have that hope enough to kind of stand enough, to fight enough until this liberation happens, you know? I was born on that land. I was fed with that bitter milk to kind of raise me to know that, you know, liberation would not come from silenced people. Liberation will come with those who fight for it. My art is my weapon. My advocation and my passion about my home without a blink any time in my 37 years is my weapon to kind of tell the stories of my people. Lots of times with me yelling in the streets or singing a song is really touching those hearts that haven't just yet realized the suffering that we have been going through. So the journey is long, but it's worth every single moment of it, until like that day when we will cry a lot and, you know, scream a lot and laugh a lot and mourn a lot, but also know that it was really worth it, you know? One of the songs that have been coming a lot during this war, watching so many mums say goodbye to their children, especially seeing the sorrow of those fathers and mothers that just lost their kids or left without three of them or four of them or five of them. The amount of loss and trauma these people have been through. The only song that kind of and sometimes heals it is the mawels that the women used to say before, like 70 something years ago, even before Israel even existed, when their husbands used to go and fight colonizers. And it says, Ya yumma wadhini kabil mamshi, like, hey mom, say goodbye to me before I go. Ma tadri bi'athrati wa namshi, you don't really know what will make me fall or like the obstacles that I will, you know, have in my journey. When the kid or the baby or the husband dies, they say, ma'a salami ya misik fayih, goodbye, you are musk that is filling the air. Hey, hey, yumma, wadda'ini qabil mamshay, ma tadri bi'athrati wa namshay. Hey, yumma, wadda'ini qabil mamshay, ما تدري بعثراتي وانا مشي يا قايد المراكي يا قايد المراكي يا قايد المراكي قيد وامشي عسى الله نلحق وضع الاحباب هي يما ودعيني قبل ما اروح هي يما
عينيك بالمعروف ما تدري بعثراتي وانا اروح ما صبر صبري ما صبر صبري ما صبر صبري لا يونس ولا نوح ولا أيوب لمن ابتلى.
And then the mom's answer.
مع السلام وين رايح مع السلام يا مسك فايح مع السلام وين بدك لك عد على دربك وردك.
That's it.